The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Ad number 205 live for June 1st, Monday, 2009.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. We are here. I'm here in New Hampshire. John, who did our lovely intro, is down in Connecticut. Pilot Pete's sitting next to me. There are quite a few people on TalkShoe. We decided we'd do this live again because the logistics worked out. We're here. Next week is WWDC. I'm going to be traveling. And then I think we've got a good couple of weeks before Pete is back. And Pete helps us immensely with these live shows. So we're here live. We've got lots of stuff to talk about. We've got questions prepped. We will see how the chat room goes. And if anybody out there on TalkShoe has a question, we can loop that in and play a little Stump the Geek as well. So we've got quite a few things to talk about here, John. You know, the first thing I wanted to mention, I had two time machine things happen here. Number one was, We all installed. By the way, how are you doing, John? Before I dive right in here,
I'm doing good. I'm a little, a little sleepy here. I think I told you I had to, get up early today. I'd begin to work by 9 and get a new employee up to speed. But it was fun. New guy, lots of energy.
Is that your replacement, John?
Not yet.
Not as far as he knows.
No, he's got a little ways to go before he gets that far.
All right.
Someday, by the time I'm going to retire, maybe.
Yeah, well, that would actually be perfect, right? That would be great. That would be great. So we all installed, or many of us installed Leopard 10.5.7 update recently. And several shows ago, long before we installed 10.5.7, we talked about an app called Time Machine Editor, which allows us to change the interval at which Time Machine starts its backups, because an hour is a little bit, too obsessive for many installations and can slow things down. So, ran Time Machine Editor, set it to 3 hours on some of my machines. It was even 8 or 10 hour intervals and it worked out fine. But I noticed, after I installed 10.5.7, my machines, I just noticed them backing up more frequently than I had previously. And I ran Time Machine Editor, and sure enough, it had all been reset back to an hour, but something very cool happened.
Really?
Yeah. It says at the top of the screen, if you go run Time Machine Editor now, which I know you're going to do, it says your settings have been changed, because apparently it stores its settings in a preference file, but of course the system doesn't read that. It reads that. And it said, click this button to revert to your previous settings. And so that's what I did. And I had to type in my, my admin password.
I didn't see that, by the way, but go on. I'll tell you what I saw.
Okay. And so you're using, I did that, and then it went back to normal or back to what I wanted, which is not normal. And all has been well, but it took me a couple of days to figure out what was going on and to remember to launch that app. So you said you saw something different, John?
Well, no, in my case, I launched it. I went to interval and it still said 4 hours, which I had it set for. I said apply and it said, well, yeah, you already got that. So,
And that was
what was interesting, though, was someone did tell us. So I think this is buried. We'll find the path here. But we did have somebody write in. And as far as I can tell, what that utility does, because I verified it by looking at the plist file, it just changes a value in a plist file that indicates, I think it's the number of seconds between or it could be minutes. No, I thought it was seconds. Between Time Machine backups.
Huh, that makes sense.
And the
sense.
Question was, should I be able, so getting a answer early in here, should I be able to just change that setting and not have to deal with that utility? And I would say it appears so for now that there's this well-defined, though it could change in the future. And I think even this utility, the warning was, the assumption that you make about a value in a plist file could change, and then it breaks. And then, so yours sounded like it got corrupted. That's really weird.
Yeah, well,
or it got set back. That's unusual, because I did not see that. So
this has happened on every single machine that I've installed 10.5.7 on. So I don't think it's a corruption thing. It was very clear that it said, yep, it went back. But of course, remember, I did my updates with the combo updater from the start. So perhaps There is, some setting differences between when we installed, upgrading from the, because you did not start with the combo updater. So maybe that's where the difference is. But in any event, it's worth going ahead and checking that just to make sure that your settings are what you think they are or what you want them to be. All right. Speaking of Time Machine, though, I have I had an issue, and it's an issue that I know is near and dear to your heart, John. One of my Time Machine backups got corrupted. In fact, it's the one that backs up the machine upon which we record Mac Geek Gab each week.
Let me guess. This is a wireless backup.
Not at all. It is a 100% wired machine. It has a wireless card, but it's never been connected that way. Gigabit Ethernet pipe straight to the, not straight, because there's no such thing. Not in my house anyway. But
okay. Because as you know, my experience, as well as many others, is that the wireless backup to the time capsule is less than perfect a lot of times. So, okay.
Right. Yeah, no. Huh. So this corrupted for whatever reason.
How did you know it was corrupted?
Well, it wouldn't back up. In fact, it told me that it couldn't mount the image.
You get the spinny? Oh, okay. So it was sitting there forever and ever.
Right. And I kept getting this message that it said the backup disk can only be mounted read only. So,
ooh.
Yeah.
Permissions?
But it wouldn't. But even then, it wouldn't mount. No. So I tried mounting it in Disk Utility, and it gave me that same message after a long time of trying to mount. And I thought, oh, that's not good. So, and I've got to go and look and see, is the house iMac on? It is. So there was a Mac OS X Hints article that I found that gave me a command line control using HDIUtil, which is the command line interface for controlling disk images. And what it let me do was I mounted the image without mounting it, without showing it on the desktop. And the command was HDIUtil space attach space dash no mount space dash read write. So mounting it, allowing me to manipulate it, but not trying to display it on the desktop, because that was the issue. And then the path to the image. So /volume/milestones is the name of my time capsule drive. And then, iMac Intel and the Mac address underneath. Right. So I did that. It took a little while, and then it mounted. It showed three things that it mounted: Apple partition scheme, Apple partition map, and then Apple HFSX. And it showed me the disk IDs for each of those, /dev/disk4s2 was the one for HFSX. So I tried to run FSCK, the command line disk utility, on that, and it failed. It said the volume backup of iMac Intel could not be repaired, and that was it. Yeah, not good. Well, that's step one. Step two was I went and launched Disk Warrior, and that took... It probably took about 2 hours. Now, this was on a machine gigabit Ethernet to the time capsule, so certainly plenty of speed there. It was just a lot of crunching to do. And who knows, another machine might have started backing up to the time capsule during this, which can always slow down disk access. But it took a while. It found that there were all sorts of problems, and it rebuilt the directory. And then I told it to apply it. Now, what Disk Warrior tries to do when it rebuilds the directory is it tries to write the new directory to a different spot than the old one. So if something happens during the rewriting of the directory, you don't lose what you had previously. With disk images, that's not always possible. And so it told me, look, if you do this, you're going to have to overwrite what's there. And if something happens in the middle, you're doomed. And sure enough, I said, well, that's fine. I was doomed before anyway. I don't really care. And it wrote it, and it worked fine. It did a long backup the first time. It had to do that deep node traversal thing, John, that you talked about. You saw in the logs before.
Yep.
But otherwise, it came up fine. And now it's still working. In fact, it ran a backup about an hour before we did the show here. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mine's been behaving. I've never had a problem. I've never had a problem with a Time Machine backup on a drive that's within the same machine, not a network interface or wireless interface.
Okay.
or at least the one in my G5, is I've never had problems. But the wireless thing, as we've discussed earlier, there are a number of issues there. So I have one new cool toy.
Okay, go ahead.
You can move on here. But no, the cool toy I have, and I'm looking at it right now. So I was doing some work, and I may go into a little detail later. But I was basically goofing around with iPhoto, and I had, I think, gotten rid of some data I didn't mean to. I was clearing out some old albums, and I think I deleted the pictures instead of, you know, just the album entries. So anyway, so I was looking for ways, and there are ways to dig into the iPhoto hierarchy or just do a Time Machine backup. But this was like, you know, a little challenge. I knew the data was not forever lost. But this was running the processor pretty hot. And this was on the machine was downstairs on a dining room table with a, you know, placemat and stuff like that. And the machine was really starting to wind up a bit as far as the fans and stuff like that. So one, I got the latest version of iStat Pro, which shows you the fan RPMs. And it was getting up to, you know, like 5,000 or something, and the temperature was getting up to about 170 Fahrenheit. So then I'm like, you know, I think, let me think what's bad about this. Well, number one, the machine was sitting on an insulator, a nice insulator, the placemat and just the table itself. So I dug through an old swag bag that, you know, we love getting at Macworld, and I actually found something that really, really helps. iRiser. I think you may have seen this.
iRiser?
It's from Matias, M-A-T-I-A-S.
Uh-huh.
.ca. If you look iRiser, if you search for that quickly, and you look at this thing, and it seems very unassuming at first. It's basically, you know, two pieces of acrylic or plastic, but it does an excellent job of elevating the machine off of any surface and allowing you to run cooler. And I noticed a definite reduction in the temperature when I use this thing, and it's neat because although they show it with what appears to be a MacBook, it works with pretty much any portable, unless it's, you know, really, you know, a huge monstrosity. But even then, and it lets you adjust the tilt to, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 degrees, depending on what you're trying to accomplish. So I keep it here very low. My goal is just to, but it's very neat. And, you know, you see the two pieces there. I mean, they pretty much, you know, it's very portable. And again, it does the job of keeping the machine elevated and cooler, because when I was rebuilding some of the, you know, when recovering some of these photos, the temperature was, I mean, I was pegging 100%, and the temperature was getting up there, and the fans were going, even with the I think they just had an SMC update, among other things, right? At least on the MacBook they did.
Okay, yeah, on the MacBook Pro they did. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've actually at my desk for years, and I don't remember when I got it, but I have a cool pad from Road Tools, which is, you know, a very, very similar thing. That my laptop sits on when it's here at my desk, and it, I guess, presumably makes a difference. I've never had heat issues, so I'm going to say it certainly doesn't make things worse. So
that was just one, and it's a nice, elegant piece of equipment. You get a little carry case, and they even have a little baby version for your iPod, which is a nice touch. And yeah, so we'll link to their product there, but it's a, you know, I think it's $40, and it comes with both a, you know, computer thing. And, but for people that put together the swag bags, yes, it's worth it, because eventually some of us may go digging through them to look for something that, we may enjoy. And in this case, I really did. So
cool. I, while we're talking about different products, I do want to talk about our first sponsor for the show. And that is Disk Label from Smile on My Mac. Now, they just released version 6, which enhances Disk Label and takes it kind of to the next level. 80 new template sets. Now, what Disk Label is, it's important to understand this. What it does is it allows you to create and print labels for your CD or DVDs that you're making on your Mac. Or, frankly, you could make the CDs or DVDs anywhere. Disk Label lets you print labels for any DVDs or CDs, even if, heaven forbid, they were created on a Windows machine. So it comes with all sorts of templates, all sorts of presets for different printers. Now version 6 has 80 new templates inside and some new design tools that allow you to create montages right there on the DVD. So if you had put together like a photo DVD tour of your vacation, you could take some of those photos and montage them up and put them right there on the cover of the DVD. So you really can kind of start the presentation before they even turn on any electronics, except maybe a light so that they could actually see, you know, see the label. And on top of this, so Disk Label is $35.95 for a single license, $54.95 for a family pack, which is up to five computers in one household, and upgrades from previous versions are $15. Now, though, you can get the individual license or the family pack for 20% off by going to smileonmymac.com/geek. So that's the special Mac Geek Gab deal, smileonmymac.com/geek for 20% off disc label for a limited time only. So if you're interested, check it out. And of course, there's a free trial available because that's how they roll over there at Smile on My Mac.
I think you should act now.
Act now. No. That's right. That's right.
And try the free trial immediately.
Yeah. Immediately. That's right. No, it's good stuff. Cool. We're getting some more comments about buzzing. I'm not sure that there's anything I can do about it. Yeah. And you're not hearing me buzzing, right, John?
No. Okay. Is it like a 60 cycle or what?
No, I think this is on the live feed, folks. I think it's just the TalkShoe interface, TalkShoe to Skype interface, perhaps. But if you're not hearing me buzzing, John, and I'm not hearing you buzzing, we're connected over Skype. TalkShoe is connected over Skype. It is an equal third party in the call, so there's nothing else we can do at the moment. So we're just going to roll forward here.
Shall we take our first caller?
Do we have? Well, yeah, I don't see that we have anybody with their hand raised. So you want to? Do we have a hand raise?
No, not yet. I haven't seen any questions. Well, there's
happening.
A hand raise. I like
okay.
That,
yeah, let's take a live call. We've certainly got some non
unscreened.
That's right. We have some pre-screen stuff that of course we prepped like any normal show, but sure, we're live. So, let's liven them up.
You better not be a crank call. I like iMac. You're up.
Are you there?
I like iMac. You're live.
Speak.
Oh,
nope.
Man.
All right. Well, that's the beauty of doing live. So we're experiencing
technical difficulties.
We will come back to you. I like iMac. And right now
it looked like he's logging off and logging on again.
Yep. So we'll go to Bill here. Bill says, I was listening to your latest episode number 204 and John mentioned battery monitors. I would like to chime in and suggest battery health monitor from Sonora Graphics. Found at sonoragraphics.com. The program is free. Versus the $15 for X battery, which you mentioned. Both seem to do basically the same functions, and free is, of course, always nice. Thought the listeners might want to check out the free options before spending hard-earned cash. I've been using Battery Health Monitor for a long time, and, like John, find the data extremely useful in caring for my MacBook Pro batteries. Now, John, you checked this out as soon as you heard about it. And
This thing rocks. So I got to say, X battery is nice because it shows... So the advantage of X battery is it lets you store history of what's happened. So you can watch over time and understand why certain things happen.
Okay, there is value in that, yeah.
And yeah, definitely. But this shows you a quick and easy view here. And what it shows you is original capacity, which in the case of the battery in my MacBook is 5,600 milliamp hours. The current capacity, which is the current maximum capacity, in my case here, it shows 89%, 5,011 milliamp hours. And then the current charge, which I'm charging right now, and it shows that. As well as charge cycles. And then what it shows, which is very useful, is next to current capacity, it shows the remaining capacity as kind of a little progress bar.
Ah.
That shows you how far away you are from battery dead. Then charge remaining is instantaneous, and then battery life remaining is another indicator based on charge cycles where they figure your battery's kind of shot. So I'm looking here, and it says I have 155 cycles, 40%. So you figure 300, yeah, maybe 400 or 500. I don't know what the rated thing is, but I guess so it bases it on two things to figure out when your machine's going to die. And actually, there is in the upper portion of the screen, it shows you little indicators. In my case, it says AC power, battery installed, and battery charge. But they actually have one, I think, battery low warning and battery depleted, or not chargeable, which I guess those two mean, dude, your battery's shot. But this is a very good tool because a lot of times, as we talked in the past, you may have issues with the battery showing low capacity prematurely, and this tool would be excellent to demonstrate that to someone like at a Genius Bar or something. Say, hey, look at this, you know, I got 10 charge cycles and the thing's at 50% life or something like that, for example.
Cool.
And I think if it's an extreme case, that this makes it very, very clear. So it's different. It doesn't show the level of detail, but I think it shows the key points that are really useful if you're trying to troubleshoot something.
Cool. Awesome. But we always like to hear about new apps. You know, Air Radar was another one of those that, you know, solved a problem with an app that we didn't realize we even needed solving in most cases. So All right. Shall we move on to Tim?
Oh, we got, hold on.
Do we have? No.
Well, I like iMac, says he's back. So you want to try him again?
I just didn't see a hand raised, so I figured I was just going to keep going.
Okay.
And there it is. There All right. Try it again, Pete.
You're live.
Hi.
We can hear you.
Is it working?
All right.
It is.
Already on. Hi, this is actually Michael Askew. I called in. I sent you all an MP3 comment a few weeks ago. I just wanted to know if anybody had any recommendations for a utility to sync to folders. I'm a big fan of Dropbox, of course, for syncing, you know, across computers, across the internet, etc. But for instance, today I had a situation where I wanted to sync a rather large folder full of video files on a remote, on an external drive with a folder on my built-in drive.
Okay, so you're talking about syncing folders, two folders on the same Mac, correct?
Correct.
Okay, cool. All right, John, do you have any thoughts on that? I used to use a piece of software called Folder Synchronizer Pro to do that, and it was very full-featured, but not entirely user-friendly, especially by today's standards, though I haven't used it in a long time, so it may be better. Do you have any thoughts while I'm looking that one up?
No, you know, there was one, actually somebody wrote in, I think it was in this week's email and audio comments about another utility very similar to Dropbox. So I love Dropbox. You know, iDisk, though it's not free. Coming up with a lot. But there was another utility which I was planning on looking at. So we'll have to dig through the notes here and find that.
Yep. Okay. So I'm seeing a lot of people mentioning ChronoSync, which is certainly in that realm. I think I've used it, but I certainly never used it for any, you know, live stuff. I think I tested it a little bit, but never stuck with it. Softobe.com was the people that made Folder Synchronizer X or Folder Synchronizer 10, and they still make it, though I think the last update was almost a year, maybe over a year ago. We did talk about ARR Sync, which Michael was saying in the chat room that he has had. We talked about that recently. And that probably is as good as you're going to get for what you're looking for out there. So there you go. Hmm. Any other thoughts to add, John?
No, I actually enjoy, I think I told you, I'm really digging Dropbox lately, especially with the recovery. And we've had a lot of people tell us the recovery feature can be really awesome sometimes when things go bad.
Got it. Cool. All right. Let's move on to Tim. We found an interesting thing here. Tim says, "Hey guys, just switched to the Mac from the PC and started to listen to your podcast to keep up to date. One thing I keep running into is I have several FireWire and USB 2 hard drives attached to my MacBook at home. And when I close the lid and unhook everything to take it to work, I usually forget to eject the disks or remove them properly." And I've seen this before too, John. This was a question that not sure why I never tried to solve this before. But anyway, he moves on. He says, "Is there a script or something I can add to the sleep or shutdown feature to unmount the hard drive either when I close the lid or go to shutdown? This may be a user routine that I need to get used to, but perhaps there's something else." Now, shutting down will unmount all the drives, so that you don't need to worry about. But sleeping won't. And that can be an issue if you sleep the machine, yank everything out, and then walk away. Now, oftentimes I've seen if I sleep the machine and start yanking components out, it'll wake the machine back up. You know, any activity on USB or FireWire tends to be oftentimes is a trigger to go ahead and wake things up. So that's a difficult thing to achieve, keeping a machine asleep while disconnecting everything. But still, it would be nice to have something that just went and ejected all this stuff. John, I think you might have found the magic answer.
Yeah, I did find the magic answer. Let me bring out the magic file with the magic answer. Now basically, our pals over at OS X Hints have a nice little article here about doing some voodoo down on the command line to basically script So the machine will detect when it's going to sleep and kick things off, and then when the machine starts up again. We won't read the scripts to you, but we'll link to the article. But I think that was the gist of this, is that they are detectable events, and they have some scripting that'll deal with that. But, you know, I think in general, you know, with both flash drives and external drives, as long as there's no pending activity, it's not the end of the world if you shut down. But because, I mean, sometimes the Apple warning is kind of scary. It's like, whoa, you didn't put your device away. And I think it shows, you know, the big red stop sign in a hand or something, you know, kind of frightening for newbies. So, but I think if you're actively writing, then yeah, that's not good.
Yep. So
has been my experience. I mean, I can't remember the last time I've had, especially a flash drive, actually not have something that I've transferred over still be there when I bring it somewhere else, even if I do just yank it from the machine that it's in, whether it be Windows or Mac.
Yeah, I don't know that I've had anything disappear. All right. We might as well go to JT here, John, because JT has a thing related to what Michael asked us.
Oh.
Right? It's sort of similar. All right, let's see if we can play a comment here.
Hey, guys. This is JT.
Huh. Or maybe we can't play a comment. Minor audio hiccup, and here we go with JT again.
Hey, guys. This is JT in Los Angeles. Love the show. I just wanted to ask a question. I do a lot of travel, and one of my biggest concerns is always syncing up folders and files and stuff so I have the stuff I need when I'm away. And I've mastered it pretty much, but I was had an idea, and I wanted to... run it by you guys. I sync all folders I need using a utility called Synchronize Pro X, and it works really great. But there's always the moments where I'm going to need library files, you know, mail folders, you know, all those things that you want to have with you that are not sync up between my computers using MobileMe and all that stuff. So my question is, if I were to just sync the laptop and make it basically a clone of my mainframe at home, what ramifications would that have? Is there anything bad about that? I mean, literally, I would just take at least the library folder at the user's level.
All right, there's a lot. I'm not sure exactly where he is. I'm pretty sure he's repairing a jet engine, and more power to him.
Yeah, on the burner side. Back in the hot side of the can.
That's right. Okay, so we got the gist here. So, you know, especially when talking about mail folders, you certainly could. So this is how I used to do things back in the day when I had a separate laptop and a separate desktop machine. I would do exactly what he is proposing. Before I went and traveled, I would sync my documents, my mail folder, all that stuff over to the laptop. I would live off the laptop. When I got back, I would sync it all back. And it worked fine. It created a stressful situation in that if I didn't, you know, plan too far ahead, then I was, you know, waiting to get out the door until this sync finished, which always seemed to take, you know, twice as long as it was supposed to. And then when I got back, I had, you know, a couple of hours of downtime or whatever it was to copy the data back. So I don't recommend doing that. There are better solutions now, as you found with regular documents, Dropbox or iDisk. Are perfect, right? I mean, maybe not perfect, but they certainly work. For mail, I would recommend using IMAP, John, if your host supports it. And if it doesn't,
if you can. And you know, that's the one thing I do not like about Cablevision, otherwise known as Optimal.
Sorry, I fired off the comment again. I don't know how I did that. Go ahead, John. You said Cablevision doesn't have IMAP.
Well, they still just offer POP 3, I guess.
I think most ISPs these days offer POP. I think IMAP is something you're gonna expect to pay for because you're using quite a bit of storage space on their server to right. hold all your mail data. Right. I mean, that if the idea is to store your mail on the server, well, okay, you know, and IMAP does. incur a much higher load, CPU load on the server than POP does. So, but you know, it certainly worth paying for setting up if you've got your own server or something like that. You know, one other thing I thought of here, John, was making the laptop the quote unquote main machine and only storing current files on the desktop. That way, when you're home, you have access to both. So it's not a problem. You've got all your old archives and stuff on the laptop, right? And you can access that from any machine over or network or however you want to set it up. But then when you leave, all you have to do is sync the current files, which of course you could do with, you know, Dropbox or iDisk or something very quickly. And then boom, you know, on the road, you've got everything with you because that's the main store. Now you've got to worry about keeping that data safe, secure, and backed up. But that's, you know, a different type of conversation. But those are my thoughts on it. You got any thought?
I think you should use Gmail's IMAP server.
Nicely done.
As Boston Geek, who says we're not paying attention to him, just stated.
That's true. Actually, so here's the thing, though. Gmail and IMAP, the way Gmail does IMAP is not normal. It's wacky. IMAP is a folder-based system, right? The whole paradigm is folder-based. Gmail's whole paradigm is not folder-based. And so what you do is you create filters in labels, rather, I guess is what Gmail calls them. And those labels translate into folders when you connect via IMAP. But the problem is, I think you can have multiple mail messages with multiple labels assigned to the same mail message, whereas with IMAP, you know, so you've got the same message in multiple folders, and that confuses the heck out of IMAP clients. Or even if it doesn't confuse them, it creates multiple copies, which, you know, if you're trying to search for things. So
okay.
I used it a little bit, and it's functional, and best of all, it's free, and these days, very reliable.
So let me ask you, because I've never really done IMAP, because none of the... I mean, at work, I have Exchange. At home, I do POP and stuff like that. But
right.
Does IMAP encourage the use of what I'd call folders or labels or some way of separating... Or do you just have one big global inbox and... Or is it how you set it up?
It for me, it's how you set it up. I've been on IMAP now for...
So could you run it like POP where all your mail comes in one feed, and except for the case of it still being on the server versus pulled off the server and on your client? I think that's probably the major difference, right?
Right. The big difference is that your client merely syncs up with the server. So if you've got...
So are you always engaging in network activity, or can you cache...
You can cache.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So you can. Well, all right. So you could do it smart. You're not going to re-download the same or re-display the same data every time.
Correct.
Got it. So it checks for a different. Okay. All right. I grok it.
Yeah. It checks for differences. That's right. Now, Apple's Mail app is one of the least efficient IMAP apps IMAP clients I've ever seen. It tries to do too much on each connection, which is fine when you're on a high speed pipe. But, you know, if you're trying to work over, you know, dial up or crummy hotel Wi-Fi or whatever, it's not so good. But
is it a Chatty Cathy?
It's a Chatty Cathy. There you go. That's right. we got to get a Chatty Cathy soundbite that we can play. That would be awesome. If anybody's got a Chatty Cathy doll and they can record a soundbite for us, that'd be totally awesome. So you know, for mail, I would do IMAP. And if you have to do Gmail, you can do it. You just have to be intelligent about it, in that you need to kind of go in eyes wide open and know that either plan not to set up labels that can apply to multiple messages, or if you do, know that, you know, your mileage may vary. So do we have
Pete's got a question
any,
for you.
Yep. And I've answered my question for Pete.
Good.
With a big solid thumbs up. Let's see. Do we have...
I think I heard the fridge going there.
I don't think so. I think that microphone's muted. That's right.
Or something.
Yeah. Do we have any questions in the room? We can't have questions in the room because Pete's not sitting at his station right now. So we're going to go to... let's go to Tommy.
What's next?
Yeah, we can do
Hold
Tommy.
Hold on, wait.
Oh, no, you got... What's going on, John? You got something to say? You know what?
No. Okay.
You know what? No, this is actually an excellent time. I want to make sure we get to our second sponsor of the show. Sorry. Pete's distracting me with a question. In case it ever comes up this is totally unrelated to what's happening right now, Pete, but in case it ever comes up, I tend not to drink light beer. So I'm sure that's not relevant to our current flow here, but
I want to speak to the person responsible for that because well, I'll tell you right now and then we'll deviate, but Dave, you know this, I got a Dogfish Head 120 minute IPA.
Nice.
As you know, this is not a light beer.
No,
this is probably as heavy as you can get and still call it beer. Yeah, I don't even know if I'd call it beer.
I don't think you can call that beer in New Hampshire.
No, right. Actually, yes. Go on.
All right. Our second sponsor for the show is Circus Pony Software at circusponies.com with Notebook version 3.0. Now, just today, they updated version 3.0 and added French and German localizations and have partnered to release an Italian version. So wide open. Now, of course, we do this show in English, so I'm assuming that most of the folks that listen at least certainly understand English, though not necessarily as their first language. But that is what they announced today. Now, Notebook, you ask, what is it? It is an electronic organizer application. It starts with the notebook paradigm. You launch and you can create multiple notebooks. Now, you can create them for different topics, for different areas of your life, however you want to do it. It's a almost blank slate that you start with. And you fill in a hierarchical notebook view initially. And then you can pull in PDFs, you can add annotations, you can add doodles. If you have a writing tablet, you can even write into your notebook. You can add keywords. You can basically organize your data any way you would like to. And then when you need to look for something, you can use what they call multi-decks, which allows you to search through not just one notebook that you're in, but through all of your notebooks. And you don't have to remember exactly what it is you're looking for. If you remember a keyword that you assigned or the date you entered it, or maybe a name embedded within whatever it was, Notebook version 3.0 from Circus Ponies at circusponies.com. It's $49.95, but of course they offer a 30-day test drive. So you can go check it out at circusponies.com. All right, so what's do we that? Have a question? We don't have a question in the room, so we will go to Tommy here, and let's
think
see.
So?
Yeah, no, you know, it's good to do it this way. I mean, yes, there's folks in the room, but of course there's you know, legions of folks listening at home and listening on the feed, so it's good that we're doing it this way. All right, so Tommy writes, I just got my MacBook Pro back from Apple Repair, and they did not erase the hard drive, which is great. But now when I connect it to my external hard drive that is used for Time Machine, it does not see the previous backup and wants to start over. I don't understand why, since it was backing up just fine before I sent it to Apple. Do you think they did something to the preference files during their testing? How would you point Time Machine back to the existing files? All right, John, you go.
Initial theory is something changed. Okay.
Yes. Okay. All right. Yeah. That's always a good place to start. I'll agree.
Well, I'm going to guess because I know at some level I can't find it exactly right now, but I do believe that in your Time Machine backup, the MAC address of the machine is buried in there somewhere, and I'm trying to find that.
It is.
I guess what I'm going to say is my guess is that they did try as a possible repair measure. Swap out the motherboard.
I'm sure
or
that's right.
Or it's something which changed. I'm thinking either the serial number or some unique feature of the machine. Now we've heard reports where they can wipe the serial number. I don't believe that's part of Time Machine, but it could be. But from what I've seen, the MAC address is buried in there somewhere.
The MAC address of the Ethernet port. If you are backing up over a network, it's actually stated in the folder name that that computer uses. Like right. I was saying before, this computer, it I called it iMac Intel when I got it because it was the first Intel right. iMac I had. So I called it iMac. It's iMac Intel dot and then the MAC address underscore sparse bundle or dot sparse bundle or whatever it is. So it's there. If you are backing up to a hard drive just inside the backups.backupdb folder, I believe the MAC address is stored as a dot file there. And there are some instructions out there. We'll find the. I know there was yet another Mac OS X Hints article that discusses how to go through and change all the pointers for the MAC address to the one on the new machine. I did it once and it worked. I moved from. In fact, I think I don't know if it was this machine or no. It's the one that's over at the house, but it worked. But you know, it's not for the faint at heart. So,
right. So we'll. So I don't know. I mean, if they actually made a record of the MAC address before they sent the machine out, which you may or may not. You know, actually, it may not be a bad idea. Just for kicks. Before you ship the machine out to get fixed, I'm thinking just, I don't know. I would run, because you can run System Profiler, or whatever we want to call it here. System Info. You know, every now and then, I believe you can save out a pretty detailed list of all of the stuff that's found. And, you know, before you ship a machine out, write that file out.
Yeah.
I'm looking here. I think it's save as. Yeah, so you can say save as.
It's not a bad idea, actually.
System Profiler, and actually I'm looking right now. Save as, and file format, System Profiler 4.0 XML, so it writes out a nice XML file, which everybody loves, and I would assume has pretty much all the stuff that you see in the System Profiler. So why not? But yeah, I see here, like for example, when you start up System Profiler under hardware, it says serial number. And there's something there. And I've heard reports, a lot of reports, where a lot of times when you get a machine back, somebody forgets to set that.
Yep.
And, you know, it's bad news for you if you have an app that checks that. I'm not aware of many apps on the Mac. I mean, I hate that sort of stuff. I got to tell you, especially being a software person. I hate all these keys. You know, I mean, Windows is full of them. You know, activation keys and dongles. Though I've seen the industry has pretty much moved away from dongles, but there's still some people that hold on to that. And there are some reasons sometimes. I mean, I'm actually working on a project at the day job where we have a piece of software and we really want to be sure that it can only run on a machine that a certain individual has access to. So,
okay,
we get one of the, I think it's called SafeNet now is the company that does that. They used to be Rainbow and probably have gone through, you know, a couple of iterations. But it's not a bad thing. You know, it's two-factor or whatever factor security that you want. Sometimes there's a reason to do it, but to subject consumers to that sort of thing, that's just wrong.
All right. So I'm going to tug on the reins a little bit here and bring us back back to Tommy's question.
What was the question?
Yeah.
Was what happened? And I think we covered what could have happened.
Yeah. So it's a motherboard change. It's the MAC address, the serial number. It is actually good to keep that data separate. I like your idea of saving a System Profiler report. That's a good idea. But it is the MAC address. We will put a link in the show notes to the Mac OS X Hints article that discusses re-engineering a time machine backup. But really, you know, unless you are running your life in such a way that you rely on going back to old backups regularly, what I would do is just take that one and archive it off. You can always use the option key and click on the Time Machine menu to browse other Time Machine disks and go and look into that old backup, even though it's not married to your machine. And then and just start anew. And then, you know, in 3 to 6 months, just throw the old one away. So. All right.
Is there a question?
There is a question in the room. It's going to be one that challenges our on the fly abilities, I think, but let's try it.
Ooh.
So go ahead. AMC podcast. You are live.
Hey guys, it's Greg from San Diego. Hey, I have a question about, PGP full disk encryption. And I think it's time to run Disk Warrior on my Mac, but okay. I'm afraid that I'm going to have to buy a completely separate license for my external hard drive to boot from to decrypt my hard drive. What are your thoughts?
No. Okay. A completely different license of Disk Warrior or of PGP?
Of PGP.
Okay, I can't speak about PGP, but Pilot Pete uses PGP, and if you try to say that 10 times fast...
the bullseye is on Pilot Pete.
Yeah, look at me. Now, here's what I did. Mine was getting a little iffy a while back, and I can't... That's the best technical description I can give you, because I can't put my finger on anything and it was doing. The computer was just sluggish. What I ultimately wound up doing was decrypting the hard drive, then working on it, and then re-encrypting it later. Not the best solution, but...
Encryption took, I don't know, days for me on my MacBook, so I guess that's the only option.
It probably took 12 or 13 hours to decrypt, whereas it said it was going to take 8 or 9 hours, and it was probably done in 2 or 3. So, and I got a 320 gig hard drive, so...
Huh. Yeah, that's what I have too. But all right, well, I was afraid of that, unfortunately.
All right, well, I guess that answers the that sends us down the right path anyway. So, thank you, Pete.
That's
excellent.
But I guess that's the Achilles heel of any of the full disk encryption products, is that they kind of confuse repair products.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Because, now, I've heard of drives,
especially the
but
ones
I haven't
tried to access the drive in its pre-decrypted, in its encrypted state.
Yep.
What I have heard of, though, is drives, and I haven't heard a lot about them, but I've heard of it slowly, is that the drives where the encryption is on the drive itself. And if you have it on the drive itself and it's handled by the hardware on the drive and you have a, fairly decent processor to handle the encryption and decryption, it's transparent, then that may get around that, but again, I think that's a pretty new area, and not it introduces probably its own set of problems, but to me that would be a better way to handle this whole encryption thing, because trying to do the image thing and encrypt and decrypt, I mean, hard drives are only so fast, and we may see better things. I think Dave and I have been chit-chatting about SSDs, solid state drives, and I think those bring the promise maybe of being able to do this a little quicker.
Oh, that's, that's a good point.
Yeah.
One of the things about those SSD drives, of course, is they don't have any, there's no moving parts, right? So the whole thought of defragmenting, or having fragmented data, I don't think it matters, right? So.
Well, it's not a mechanical operation, so I would think there's a much less impact.
Right.
Still, if it's spread about, if the memory controller likes reading data that's contiguous versus spread all over the place, but I would think not nearly as much an impact as moving a motor around or a stepper motor and, a platter and stuff like that. So, I think you and I were talking again, we may be kicking the tires on some of these drives, because they're not at the level, hold on, sorry.
Yep.
They're not at the level yet, I think, of capacity or price, but they're getting there. And I think, I predict in 5 to 10 years, we're not going to see any more mechanical drives.
I agree.
All solid state.
Yeah. I think it'll be less than 10, probably pushing into the 5 range. Yep.
Yeah, I'm good for 2 seconds. People are talking. Now, I had to clear my throat, but maybe I'm consistently better now. I don't know. I'm just reading the comments here. So anyways, yep. Dave, where are we at? Oh, my gosh. Look at this. It's been...
We have... let's see. Mike's question. I'm looking here at some of these Mike, that we have prepped. We're going to do Mike and we're going to do Russell. And then if there's another one in the room, you wanted to.
No, that's good.
Okay.
All right.
Go. So I got to get to Mike, though. So Mike calls in and says,
"Get the mic button.
Hey, guys. My name is Mike. I'm from New Orleans. And my 1.5 gigahertz G4 iBook that's about 5 years old is jealous of my new computer. We just bought a MacBook refurb from Apple Direct, and I did the migrate using the migration tool. And I know what you're going to say. I'm noticing that my old computer is slower because I got a new computer. Well, no, it's extremely slow in comparison to what it used to be before I did the migration. So I'm calling to see, is there anything in particular that I should do or look for to help my speed up? The memory is maxed out on the machine. I got about 12 gigs of free space on the hard drive right now. I'm running macOS 10.5 on the iBook. Just let me know what I can do. And now's when you're going to cut me off.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right, John, take this. Do you want me to take this one? You talked a lot on the last one, and you had to clear your throat. You want me to roll with this here?
No.
Okay, go.
I can keep going.
All right,
I'm going to roll, brother.
Roll.
Well, no, I'd say one of the first things. So whenever you're questioning the relative performance of your machine, you got to get the facts, right?
Yep.
So I would say something, because a lot of times I've questioned, especially as of late, because I'm starting to run apps that push the limits of the machine. You got to know what your machine is doing and if it's, you know, menu meters. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Number one.
Yep.
You want to look at processor. You want to look especially at disk usage and processor to figure out if you think your machine is running slow, there may be a very good reason. You may be, you know, asking too much of it. So, whoa, what was that?
Pete's breaking things up. Sorry, I just had to mute his. I had to mute his mic. Sorry.
So, anyways, and I found this a lot of times when I've been troubleshooting and just saying, "Why is my machine such a dog?" I mean, on some machines they have a disk light already. So if you see the disk light on continuously, that means you're swapping out or something's going on. Processor, you know, menu meter shows you that as well. Now the other thing I noticed is that there's a point on the Mac at least when it starts kind of falling over as far as performance, and that's when. When you see your VM stats page outs start to be non-zero or swap files start to take up space and stuff.
Yep.
Then you're in a situation that's kind of a death spiral. It's not going to get better. Unlikely it'll get better. It'll get worse. So that's my initial suggestion for just trying to peg what the, and I think you have a little more detail, but Dave, but some initial things to try to identify, is it my disk? Is it my processor? What the heck is making this system a dog?
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, running Activity Monitor, looking at CPU usage to try and figure out what app is out there.
Now, you mentioned Activity Monitor, so that I don't know if you have any more detail on that, but that's certainly one which I guess you could sort by CPU and then see who's doing this.
Exactly. So that's what I would do is launch Activity Monitor. The first thing I do is look at all processes. So you'll see in the upper right next to the filter search, it will... If you've never run Activity Monitor before, it says My Processes. You want to change that to All Processes. And then I click on the CPU icon until the triangle is pointing down. And what that will do is it will float to the top any app that is using more CPU than anyone else. So that's step one. Step two is to take a look at disk activity. That's down at the bottom of Activity Monitor. It's in the middle of the what Apple calls tabs. They look like one big button that you know, has been like segmented. I don't get it, but anyway, that's their term for it. It is a tab. So I click on disk activity there and just make sure that nothing is thrashing the drive, because that, even without CPU usage, that will slow things down. Now, of course, if something is thrashing the drive, you've got to figure out what that is. And, you know, then you're back to looking at CPU monitor. If you go in Activity Monitor and you check out the view menu and go to columns, there are a jillion, well, not a jillion, but maybe 12 things out there that you can choose to show or not show. I always make sure I see R size, which is real memory. So the column name is R size. In the actual columns, but in the menu at the top when you select it, it's real memory. And so I look at that, just trying to get a feel for what is taking up RAM. Because if you've got some app, and this happens to me with iCal, if I leave iCal running overnight, it will bloat up and hold 2 to 3 gigabytes of RAM. Now, this is because I have recurring events and no end date on them, and it's a known but not widely acknowledged bug in iCal. That it will just try and create more of these all night long. So I have to remember to quit it. Otherwise, if I don't, my machine crawls in the morning and I have to quit iCal, but it often takes like 5 minutes for it to quit because it's got to kind of extract itself from all that swap memory and virtual memory that it's gone and created. So, you know, looking at that, CPU and R size are the two that I kind of keep an eye on just to get a feel for what's going on. And with Safari, just because it's such a memory waster. quit it at least once a day if you're, you know, if you're,
you know,
not.
I was going to mention that because I sense that Safari caches things way more often than it really needs to, or maybe it's over ambitious about that. And I don't know if there's a setting somewhere where you can kind of tell it to back off a little bit, but sometimes I just, because I'll look sometimes and what's taking all the time is Safari and it's doing nothing except sitting on the Apple page or something. And it's taking 100% out of right. 200 with a dual core machine, of course, but still I'm like, what are you doing? You're a browser. How can you possibly consume all processor? I don't get it.
Right. Well, it does a lot. You know, it's got plugins, it's got, but it's not
efficient. Yeah, but when you're just sitting at a web page that's doing nothing, it shouldn't be consuming everything.
Yeah, but it's Safari, John.
We are Safari of Borg. You will be assimilated.
Yeah, that's right. It's Safari. If it needs the processor, that's what the processor was built for, John. There's a factory in Taiwan that builds processors specifically to be totally consumed by Safari.
Sorry, I want the satisfaction of seeing something happen.
Oh. Look, if you're looking for satisfaction, that's the next podcast over. No.
I hope not.
I hope
not.
No. Okay, so we have at least one more question to go, and I think we've got somebody in the room. If Pete, okay, so we are live, or so I'm told. Is this Nevis?
Hi, Dave. This is Ron from South Jersey.
Hi, Ron.
First time, long time listener podcast, first time caller. I have a question concerning software. Question concerning financial software. I've been a long time user of Quicken, but I've been thinking about using a more Mac friendly financial program. Do you guys have any recommendations?
All right, so you know, I'm the wrong guy to ask, I guess, because I've
really?
Been a Quicken user.
Because you're like the business guy here.
Well, okay, so maybe I'm the right guy.
Because I got nothing. I'm simple, man. I'm just a checkbook type of guy. And yeah. Anyways, go, Dave.
Okay, so yeah, I am a business guy. I have three LLCs and one C Corp. And then I also file two Schedule Cs, one for some of the income that funnels in from the computing businesses, including, you know, TMO. And then I also file a Schedule C as a musician because I deduct my mileage and claim my income. So I do track all of that. Well, my personal finances, I track in Quicken. My company finances, I still use QuickBooks. And I've been relatively happy with those. I like the way that Quicken interfaces with the banks that I use. I'm with Bank of America and Citibank. But there's, you know, there's, and I think Lisa, we have an account with TD Bank North or something too, but it interfaces fairly well with all of those and pulls things in. And to be frank, it's an interface with which I am comfortable and have been using for years. So I'm using the latest version of Quicken for Mac. And, you know, off the top of my head, I can't even tell you what that is, but I'm sure it's out there. I think it might be 2000.
I think 09 is out now.
No, 09 is not out. No? Okay. Well, and that might be the death knell for me. They say it's coming this summer, but from what we've seen at Macworld Expo and such, Quicken Financial Life for Mac is not Quicken.
Right.
It's this new, whole, different, watered-down disaster from what I've seen. So I hope it's I hope it's better than what we've seen at Macworld, because if it's not, then I'm just going to stick with 07. I think it's 07 that I'm with right now. But it might be 08. Whatever it was before, that's what I'm on.
Yeah, that's the only reason I still run parallels.
Yeah. It's 07. Yeah. Yeah.
Dave?
Yes?
Speaking of Macworld, I think, you know, through our friend Paul, I think I've heard some things are ramping up, I think.
That's what I hear. I have no inside knowledge on that.
He's mentioned that, you know, there are vendors signing up and sessions are being scheduled, and I think it's going to be unique.
Yes,
and a good show.
Yeah, so I'm looking out here. I just want to kind of finish up this financial thing. So there's a lot of people like you, Pete, that say that they're using Parallels to run Quicken 98 for Windows, I'm trying to think. There's other stuff out there. That's good if you don't need something totally all consuming. I really I really do like Quicken. It allows me to create custom reports, and it is sort of a behemoth. And if all you need to do is track your expenses, there are other apps out there. I don't see them coming through. I know somebody out there had suggested some. Cha-ching, I think, was one. But again, these are, you know, much different target and much different scope, a much smaller scope. There it is, Victor back in with Cha-ching. And Evan had said Squirrel was another one. So we'll put links to those out there. Check them out. I don't know anything about them other than that there are people, many people that use them for simple record keeping and finances.
Well, and depending how far in depth you are, like my life is in there for 13 years. I'd be so difficult to swap out.
I have no desire to recreate my data. And that's the same thing that I have with Quicken. And that's what scares me about this Financial Life 2009 disaster. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But, you know, speaking of trade shows, John, so yeah, Macworld is it's in February, as we know.
Oh, that's right. The reschedule. Right? And now you're off to the Mecca of Mac development.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. So on Sunday afternoon, I leave for WWDC. We're going to the keynote Monday morning. I am going to lay down a prediction here that iPhone OS 3.0 will be released next week. And I'm pretty confident. Well, confident in this. Yeah.
Well, I think they've, not that I know anything about this, but I do believe that they're up to beta 5 at least for the developer release. So they've been making some steady progress on the developer beta program.
Yep. So I think we'll see that. As far as Mac stuff, you know, obviously I'm expecting more progress on Snow Leopard. I don't have any inside info to share there yet. And if I get some that I can share, then I will. The sessions, of course, at WWDC are covered by NDA, which gets a little frustrating at times, but I completely understand why they do that.
Well, you know what you want to do
better
is
than the alternative of them.
Well, I just saw our friend Kirshen here. Apparently I guess they had an Iowa code camp, which in Iowa, what else are you going to do? Sorry. I mean, Connecticut snob. But no, she's actually skilled in iPhone development and did a session. So I guess out in Iowa, they have code camps like they do in many places. So so I just thought I'd pass that along with a URL and everything. So we will definitely link to that. Thank you very much.
Cool. Yeah. So, you know, I'm looking forward to it. WWDC is always a fun time. It's becoming more and more of a networking event than it used to be. You know, it used to just be heads buried in code and
oh, no, I got to shake my fist at this comment here. Well, Evan says iPod Touch will get a camera. I don't know about that.
Oh, there's been a lot of talk about that, John.
You know, because then what separates it from the phone? I mean, you see the spot in there. I mean, I have one. You have one, right?
Yeah.
And it looks like they you know, use the same case design in a sense. But, wow, if it did have a camera and one that didn't suck. So I'm sorry, iPhone camera.
What are you trying to say, John?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to turn into the iPhone
That's right. Geek-ab. iPhone geek cab. We have that URL.
That's Michael's job.
For another day.
I'm sorry.
That's right. All right. You know, I think it's time to kind of fade out here. There is one thing I wanted to talk about this weekend. On a whim, I called Comcast to see if DOCSIS 3 was available here. And it
DOCSIS
is.
3? What is DOCSIS, Dave?
So DOCSIS is the cable modem standard. And DOCSIS 3 is the next rev of that standard. And it allows for faster speeds. And the way it works, it's actually interesting. Cable modems prior to DOCSIS 3, which includes most of the cable modems that most of us have, assign one channel for the downstream link and one channel for the upstream link. And those channels by the
channel. So you're talking a channel through the fiber or cable or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just like your TV tunes into a channel.
So it's a frequency with a certain bandwidth.
You got it.
On that wire.
Exactly.
Okay, so one channel's good. More channels are probably better. Go on.
Exactly. And so what DOCSIS 3 does is instead of limiting it to one channel on the downstream and one on the upstream, it allows you to go to four channels on both the downstream and the upstream. So
shut up.
Much faster speeds.
Wow.
So right now I'm on a DOCSIS 3 plan. I have guaranteed 22 megabits down and 5 megabits up. And it also takes advantage of Comcast, what they call their power boost technology. So I've seen over 30 down and over 10. I got over 11 up right now.
Is power boost the like burst thing?
Yes.
Like for the first 30 seconds,
exactly.
It's really fast, and then it, or however many seconds, and then
right.
It backs off.
And then it ratchets down to whatever your maximum is. Yeah. So there's that. And then I think they also offer a plan that's 50 down and
wow.
10 up. Yeah. But here's the thing, you know, so when I was there, I said, well, how much more is it? And prior to that, I had their second tier plan. So they've got four tiers, 12 down, 2 up, 16 down, 2 up, 22 down, 5 up, 30
whoa, whoa,
down,
whoa,
10
whoa,
up.
Whoa, whoa.
Lots of plans. So I was on their 16.2, but my cable modem, the old one that I had, wouldn't even let me do that. So I thought, well, while I'm here, I'll just upgrade to the DOCSIS 3. Let's check it out. It cost me $10 more a month. And it's fast when I run speed tests. But, you know, I'm going to give it a week. I'm looking forward to uploading the podcasts in a moment here this evening to see how fast they go. But I'm not thinking I need 22 down and 5 up here. In fact, I might go all the way back down to 12 megabits down and 2 megabits up. I just don't know how much speed I need. I don't know. The power boost really kind of evens it out for those little, you know, bursts of bandwidth that you need. And 2 megabits up is plenty, man. You know, I was happy when I got 768. So am I?
Now we
got
to hear
too.
Similar to you. So here, Optimum Online is a cable fiber hybrid, which, you know, there's fiber somewhere,
right?
But cable to
cable.
The house,
right?
And they offer what they call Optimum Online Boost.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah.
30 megabits per second down and 5 megabits per second up, and it's an extra $10 a month. Right now, I pay. I think because I also get cable from them,
right.
But not phone service, though they keep pestering me about it. Guys, stop it. All right. but anyways, it's like, so it's $10 a month extra. I think it's similar to the Comcast deal you have, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just right. It's just a little bit more to bounce up now. Yeah. So it starts at whatever price it starts at. I think it's, I don't know, let's say $40 a month for Comcast low end plan. And then it's $10, you know, a pop to get up. And then the final step, I think, costs an extra 25. So, you know, it is what it is, but I don't know. It's the upstream is the really important thing to me. Once I get above, you know, once I was above like 6 megabits, even 8 megabits downstream, My life was okay. You know, bumping up to that 2 megabits on the upstream, that makes a big difference when sending out files or sending out emails with big attachments or anything like that. I've got 5 megabits now. Am I using it now? No. What's Skype say we're using? 12 kilobits. Okay. Well,
that's actually what I'm seeing. Yeah, I'm seeing five up, about 12, or seven up, 12 down.
Yeah, it's dynamic depending on which one of us is talking and all of that. But,
right.
you know, I mean, it's like, okay, I need low latency, but that's not going to change. I don't know. I'll have to see, but I don't see myself keeping this. And it's not the $120 a year as much as it is. Well, if I don't need to spend the money, I won't. So,
well, I got to think too, when I was thinking about this, you know, my wireless bandwidth is only so much.
Yep.
I mean, I'm happy with,
yeah, but your wireless bandwidth, unless you're still on 802.11b, You've got more bandwidth wireless than you have from your cable company.
Let me think. Potentially, though, I'm in G mode.
Yeah, so right. You're at 54, so figure cut that in half. You're at 20.
Which is 5 megabits, right?
You're at 20, megabits. 20 something. Right? So, I mean, you cut that in half, you're still okay.
Well, I'm saying it's close.
No, that's 5 megabytes, John, not megabits.
Hmm?
Right? If you're cutting 54 megabits down.
I'm sorry, you're correct.
Yeah. So, you know, cut that in half. You're still at 20, you know, let's say you're at 20, right? You don't have a full signal, so you're at 20. Is your connection faster than mine is right now? But again, what am I going to, you know, what do I care about that? So
I think, though, you know, there's a battle that I hear going on, which is more and more people. I don't know how much streaming you have done, Dave, but this whole equal access thing or net neutrality is the cable companies, I suspect Comcast is one of the worst, is these guys don't like people streaming video and movies over their network because, you know what, they can't get the revenue.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So yeah. If I get my TiVo or my Hulu or whatever, and more things are offering HD, that's less money for the cable companies who would like to charge you for that as well. Right. So we got this battle where, and we've heard time and time again, Comcast gets accused of traffic shaping or just...
That was once, and they fessed up to it, and now they're not doing it anymore.
Well, at least one of the people I follow and I think follows me keeps pointing out that something weird is happening whenever he tries to stream video. So I don't know. It could be transitory. It could be wireless because I think that's a potential bottleneck. If your wireless connection is, if you're in a busy neighborhood, you may get a point where something weird's happening or some neighbor turns on the microwave and, well, there goes your streaming movie.
That's right. That's right. All right. So if you want to contact us, you can email us at feedback@macgeekgab.com. John, that is...
Was that feedback@macgeekgab.com, Dave?
It sure was. Feedback.
And you know, I'd love to call. And if you wanted to call us, I think, Dave, you would probably call us at 206-666-GEEK, which is...
4335. You can see the excellently prepared show notes at MacGeekGab.com, and you can Skype us to MacGeekGab. So, John, we got to figure out a time to podcast next week because I'm going to be at WWDC, and we should
Well, you're going to get that rockin' hotel bandwidth, right?
I will. My bandwidth at the Milano has been great every time I've been there, including Macworld when everybody else was complaining, so I don't know. But I also have another toy that I was playing with this weekend. I have one of the Verizon MiFis to play with next week at WWDC.
So think, in a nutshell, I've read about this.
Yeah, we'll talk about 3G. It. We'll talk about it. We're not talking about it now. We're talking about it next week. There's way too big of a discussion to have, so you can look it up if you want.
I see Victor loves it, but all right, so I won't mention that it's a 3G to Wi-Fi.
No, you're not going to mention it. It's not module. We're going to talk about it next week. Okay.
But can I really?
Nope. iPhoneAlley.com is Michael Johnston's home when he is not here, converting the podcast to AAC for your interactive enjoyment. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit 9 from Barebone Software, Disclabel from smileonmymac.com/geek gets you a 20% discount, and Notebook from Circus Ponies at circusponies.com, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. And with that, we're out of here.
Comments?
Yeah, we like iTunes comments. They're good.
Polite, positive comments we like.
We like them all.
Well, we like them all, even if they're... Yeah.
We like honest comments. Let's just put it that way.
We like it when you keep it... No, don't keep it real. No, you can keep it real. Whatever.
That's right. But whatever you do, take care of your shoes.
What?
And don't get caught.
Maynard.